This is Audible.
Oasis Audio presents The Five Love Languages by Dr. Gary Chapman, read for you by Dr. Chapman. For Oasis Audio, I'm Wayne Shepherd talking with Dr. Gary Chapman, the author of The Five Love Languages, a revised edition, Gary?
Yes, after all these years, we've done a little tweaking on the text.
So how much different is this new edition?
Well, it's not radically different. I didn't change the five love languages.
You didn't add five more?
But we do have more contemporary examples of couples learning to speak these languages. Yeah.
For those who are picking this up for the first time, take me all the way back to the beginning, which was what? Nearly 20 years ago now.
Yeah, it first came out in 1992.
Did it? Okay.
And I remember the publisher said to me when it first came out, you know, this is a nice little book. I think it'll sell a few thousand copies.
Did you have trouble getting a publisher?
No, not really, because I had already published two books, and so there was no trouble getting it published. But I think all of us underestimated what would happen to this book.
Mm-hmm. Tell me the story. What has happened to this
book? Well, you know, it's been out now for 15, 16 years, and every year it has sold more than the year before. Total sales in English now is over 5 million copies, been translated in 38 languages around the world. So it has really just blown our minds to sit back and watch, you know, how this book has been used to help so many couples learn how to reconnect with each other.
For those who don't know the story, where did this come from in your own heart and mind, Gary?
Well, it came out of my counseling experience. You know, I've been in marriage counseling for over 35 years now, just working with hundreds and hundreds of couples. And I realized that after a while that I was hearing the same stories over and over again. They would sit in my office and one of them would say, I just feel like he doesn't love me. And the other one would say, I don't know. I don't know what they want. You know, I do this and this and this, and they don't feel loved. I don't understand this. And so I would try to help them understand what made her feel loved, what made him feel loved, so that they could start, you know, expressing love that way. So I went through my notes after probably 12 years of notes and asked myself, what are people crying for? You know, when they say I don't feel loved, what do they want? And their answers fell into five categories. I wasn't looking for five. It's just they fell into five categories. And it was later then I called them the five love languages. But I started using the concept in my counseling and in small groups. And every time I did, people got it, you know, and they said, oh, yeah. And so after a while, I thought, you know, if I could put this in a book and if I could write it in the language of the common man, I could help a lot of people. There's not a lot of psychological terms in this book or, you know, theological terms. It's just I'm trying to write so the average guy and gal can get it.
It's simple. It's straightforward. It's easy to understand.
Yeah.
Isn't it amazing how God has used that?
Well, it is. You know, and a lot of people have said to me, you know, I read that and I thought, why didn't I think of that? You know, I mean, it seems so simple, and it is simple. Now, it's not always easy to implement.
Right.
Because many of us grew up speaking only one or two of these languages. That's all we heard in our family. So if you talk about physical touch, and I was not touched, I was not in a touchy-feely family, that's hard for me to learn to touch. And the same thing is true with words of affirmation. If you didn't get words of affirmation, it doesn't seem natural to you to be saying these things, you know, to your spouse. So it's not easy for everybody, but it is simple to get the concept. And the good news is you can learn to speak these things. And when you do, it makes a tremendous difference in your marriage.
You must have collected stories through the years of people whose marriages have literally been saved because of the five love languages. Can you tell me a couple of those stories? I even have one of my own. I talked recently with a cousin of mine who's in his 40s. He and his wife are separated. They're still separated, but he is devouring your book. He came to me with it. He said, hey, have you ever heard of this book, The Five Love Languages? See, this is great stuff. I'm going to win my wife back with this.
Wayne, every week when I do marriage seminars, I do about 30 seminars a year all over the country. They're Saturday events. Every Saturday, I have half a dozen people come by and say to me things like, you know, we were that close to divorce. Somebody gave us your book. We read it. It made sense. We tried it. It turned our marriage around.
What have you got to lose, right?
Absolutely. You know, and so, yes, and the book is just filled with these kind of stories, you know, of course. But every week I hear that. And to me, it's so encouraging because it says to me that the book is continuing to speak to people. People are still discovering this book. You know, after 16 years, they're just now discovering. And that's new to them. And when you do discover it and apply it in your marriage, it makes a tremendous difference in your marriage.
Gary, tell me more what goes on inside you when you hear people come to you and and say, God has used your book this way in my life. But for both you and your wife, because this has been a team project, hasn't it?
Well, it has been. And, you know, my wife and I originally wanted to go to Africa. That was our goal, to go to Africa and teach in a seminary, train national workers how to reach their people for Christ. And we were turned down because of my wife's health. And they said she would not survive in another country. Well, you know, she's done well through the years. She's learned how to cope with things, and she's done well. And we were very disappointed. It was very disturbing to us. But then as the years went along and I began to write books and so forth, you know, they send us all the editions of all the foreign, send us copies of that. And
you're fluent in all those languages.
Yeah, right. People think if I write in their language, I can read their language. But but my wife and I pray for the countries. And we pray for the books when the books come in. And I don't know, two or three years ago, we had opened up a box of books. And I looked up at my wife, and she was crying. And I said, Carolyn, why are you crying? She said, Gary, I'm just remembering. We wanted to go to the mission field. And now your books are all over the world. And it was just that moment of, you know, in which we just realized the sovereignty of God over our lives. Mm-hmm. He had all this in mind. You know, when we were turned down for the mission field, it never crossed my mind to write a book. In fact, it never crossed my mind to get into counseling either.
God had a better idea.
God has a way of channeling our lives where He's prepared us to minister. When I went to college, I never thought about going into counseling. In fact, when I was in graduate school and seminary working on my PhD, they didn't even have a PhD in counseling in seminaries. They didn't have a master's degree in counseling in seminaries. So my counseling, I learned after I got out of school. After I got my PhD, I learned how to counsel. And so my PhD was in adult education. How do adults learn, you know? But I got in the church and I found out people are hurting in their marriage and they want to talk about it. And so I read everything I could and learned everything I could. And all of my counseling, you know, came out of the foxhole.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Very interesting. I'm sure you talk about this in the book, but what if a husband and wife aren't on the same wavelength at all? Yeah. And let's say the wife picks up this book, thinks this is great, and wants to implement this, but her husband's not cooperating.
Well, you know, I find that often in my counseling. A wife will come alone, or a husband will come alone, and say, my husband will not come for counseling. He won't even read a book. He won't even talk about us. And they come very defeated, but they come also asking, is there anything I can do? And what I've done many, many, many times through the years, after I've heard their story and felt their pain, I share the concept of the five love languages and how all of us desperately need to feel loved. And that just as the wife feels unloved sitting in my office, the husband probably feels unloved too. He's at home, but he won't come for counseling, but he doesn't feel loved either.
He's clamped up about it.
Yeah, right. And so I share with her that concept and that the most powerful thing we can do for another person is to choose to love them in their language over a long period of time. Unconditionally, no matter how they respond.
No payback?
No payback at all. Just don't expect anything. And over and over again, I've seen those husbands, or sometimes it's the wife, who melts when they start to get love in their own language. You know, I remember years and years ago, a wife stopped by my office and she said, I'm on my way to the lawyer's office. I don't know why I came in here. I know I've heard about you. I knew this is where you worked, and I just came in to see if you'd happen to be free. And I just want to say, I don't know why I came here. And then she poured out her story of a husband who basically had neglected her for 20 years. She said he works all day. He has an automotive shop in the backyard. He works on cars in the evening. One night a week, he goes out with the guys and drinks. He doesn't get drunk, but he comes home. And she said, he expects me to have his meal ready every night. He expects me to have his clothes clean. He expects me to have sex with him at least once a week. And that's all there is to it. And I get nothing out of it. And she said, I've just had it. But after I explained this concept to her, and this was the first case where I'd ever done this, I said, would you be willing to do a 6-month experiment with me? And I explained the concept. You love him in his language no matter how he responds. And she said, well, Dr. Chapman, I guess I don't have anything to lose. So she called the attorney from my office and said, I'd like to postpone my meeting. And so we started this process. I met with her every 2 weeks. And the first 2 weeks, he didn't have any response at all. No response at all. And after the second 2 weeks, he said to her, what's going on with you? And she said, well, you want to know the truth? I've been going over there for counseling. And she said, I'm trying to be a better wife. He said, well, I knew something was going on. And so she kept speaking his love language, and about another 3 weeks or so, he said, I don't know what you're trying to do, but it isn't going to work. And she said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, you've been kind, and he said, I don't know, it's just not going to work. And she said, well, look, I told you what I'm doing. I'm trying to have a better marriage. I'm trying to be a better wife. And so he walked away, and it was probably another week, and he said to her, he said, I don't know what you're doing, but it's not fair. She said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, you've been very kind to me. And he said, you know, I'm not much of a husband. He said, it's not fair. She said, look.
He's feeling the weight, isn't he?
He's feeling it now, see. And she said, well, I told you what I'm doing. I'm just trying to be a better wife. It's probably another month that he came and said to her, you got anything I can do for you? She said, well, if you'd like. So she asked him to do something for her, which was in keeping with her love language.
Sure.
And then about every couple of weeks, he would say to her, anything I can do for you? So she was teaching him how to speak her love language. He knew nothing about the concept, you know, but she was teaching him how to love her. And after the whole thing was over, she told me, Doc Chapman, she said, Doc Chapman, I would never have believed it. I would never have believed that man could love me like he's loving me. And I've never met the man, but he tells people in the community, and they've told me, he said, you know that Dr. Chapman? He said, that man is a miracle worker. He said, change my wife. But the fact is, you know, I'm not a miracle worker, but love is a miracle worker. Love works miracles in people's lives.
What's the oldest couple you've ever talked to who's used the five love languages to turn things around?
Well, I specifically think of a couple who've been married for 30 years, and I give that story in the book. 30 years they've been married and had a miserable marriage and turned the whole thing around with the five love languages. Mm-hmm. But I have many couples who come to me who say, you know, we've been married 40 years or 45 years, but, you know, this thing has helped our marriage. We had a fairly good marriage, you know, but, man, it's better now.
By that time, you've learned just to tolerate each other.
That's
and
right.
Just coexist, right?
Yeah, or you have learned, you know, how to work with each other, how to accept the things they're not going to change, and you've changed some things, and you've learned how to not fight every day.
So in many ways, it's even more amazing that a couple like that can find new hope and new life in their marriage.
Yeah, and that's what encourages me, is that all ages, you know, a lot of couples say to me, of course, you know, somebody gave us this book for a wedding gift, and we read it before we got married. And I said, well, that's good, because then when you come down off the high, you've got the concept.
And you will come down.
Yeah, you will come down. Then you know how to love each other. But also, we have a lot of older couples who say, you know, we thought we couldn't learn anything else, but we've learned something here in this five love languages.
Mm-hmm. Does your wife have people come up to her and say, boy, that husband of yours, he must have it all together. He's written the book on the five love languages. He must be a great husband.
Well, you know, if they've read any of my books, they know any of my other books, they know that we had a lot of struggles in our marriage in the early years. I've been very open about that. And my wife and I agreed years ago, if we were going to help people, we had to be open and honest with them. But the reality is, you know, life is good when you love each other and you speak each other's language. I never walk out of the house, Wayne, never, but what my wife will say something positive to me about, you're the greatest, hope you have a good day, it's going to be wonderful, thanks for all you do. You know,
Let me guess, your language is
words of affirmation.
Yeah.
And before I leave the house, I always take the garbage out. I always pick up things.
Acts of service.
So, you know, really, it creates a happy, warm, loving relationship, which is what God intended marriage to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just a couple of weeks ago, Wayne, my wife came home to me and said, you know, I met this lady in the grocery store. My wife always meets people in the grocery store.
She's that kind of person.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
I've met her, I know.
She talks to strangers and spend 30 minutes with them. But she said, this lady said to me, after she found out who I was, she said to me, you know, that book on the five love languages of children, which is, you know, another book that I wrote on this topic with Dr. Ross Campbell. She said, we have a 10-year-old son. And she said, he's just been obnoxious. And she said, we've had such a hard time with him. And she said, I read that book and I realized that his love language was words of affirmation. And we realized that we had been giving him critical words for just a long time because he just didn't do things. We were on his case all the time verbally. And she said, we realized we were just killing this kid. So my husband and I agreed that we were going to start looking for positive things about him and we were going to start verbalizing positive things to him. She said, we did that, and she said, within 2 weeks, his whole countenance had changed. She said, it's amazing what happened when we started giving him positive words.
They blossomed, don't
they? Yeah, and she said, now he's doing the things we tell him he needs to do because he feels loved by us. And she said, you tell your husband that that book has worked miracles for our son. And so those kind of stories also I hear, not only on how this works in marriage relationships, but how it works with children and teenagers. Let's face it, you know, teenagers are going through a lot of changes inside, emotional and intellectual, and parents who don't understand this concept, the teenager won't feel loved. You're loving them, but they don't feel loved. And, you know, they sit in my office after they've gotten into trouble, and they say to me, my father doesn't love me. He loves my brother. He doesn't love me. And I know the father loves the kid, mm-hmm. you know, but the kid doesn't feel loved. So I'm hoping that, you know, the love languages of children and teenagers will continue to help parents do what they really want to do, and that is love their children effectively.
I know there are many editions of this book, different aspects of the love languages. You and I have talked before about, you have to be careful, of course, for instance, physical touch, but a manager to his employees.
Yeah.
There are lessons to be learned here of how to manage people.
Yeah, and we're working now. I'm working with Dr. John White on a project that will take this into the marketplace because we believe it has tremendous implications in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. If people feel appreciated, and normally in the marketplace we use the word appreciate rather than love, but it's an emotional thing.
Yes.
If you feel appreciated by your employer, then you work. You know, you give yourself to the job. I was, in a business some time ago, and I met a guy who said to me after he heard this concept, he said, you know, I've been working for this company for 20 years. I've been very creative. I think I've done a good job. I've made a real contribution to the company. But I've never had anyone in this company verbalize to me that they appreciated what I was doing. Hmm. I almost cried. Mm-hmm. You know, 20 years of working and nobody had ever spoken his language.
That's just punching a time clock,
yeah.
isn't it?
And he didn't feel loved, even though he felt he was being creative and made a real contribution to the company. So, I think if managers and owners can get this concept, it has tremendous application in the workplace.
Gary, what is more important, that we understand ourselves and know what our love language is, that we're hoping that someone will speak into our life, or that we learn the love language of those around us?
I think it has to be both, Wayne. It can't be one-sided. Certainly, we need to understand our love language. That way, we can communicate to people. If you want to do something for me that would be meaningful, this is what it would be, you know. So we need to understand it so we can reveal ourselves to each other, and especially in close relationships, like in marriage or family. But I think also we have to learn the language of the other person. Otherwise, we can be very sincere and still be missing each other. And I believe there are literally thousands of couples who are loving each other, but they're not connecting. They are sincere, but they're not touching the heart of the other person. And that is why I think this book has helped so many couples, is that they were trying, they wanted to love, they thought they were loving. In fact, in their heart they were loving, but they realize, ooh, it's not getting through. But if I do this, it gets through, you know? And so when that happens, then the whole marriage flourishes.
Where is this going? What's next for you?
Well, I don't know. I think, as I said, I'm working on a project on taking this into the marketplace because I think it does have implications there. That's my next project. I'll be working on that next year. Other than that, I don't know. You know, I just kind of sit back and watch what God is doing with what's
open his
happened.
Leading, huh?
That's right.
Well, Gary, I think I speak on behalf of all those people who are going to hit the play button on this audiobook now and thanking you for these many years of development of this theme, this simple theme of the five love languages. It has the power to change a person's heart and their marriage, really, doesn't it?
Well, I really believe that's true, and that's why I'm so excited about this book. I think it's going to continue to reach out to touch people. And I think the reason this book has been so successful is that the people who have read it or heard it share it with their friends, and then their friends share it with their friends. And so the circle keeps going out. And I believe that together we can change things in this country. If we can restore the family, marriage being first, and then the family, so it becomes a loving, supportive unit, we can change the climate of our society.
The Five Love Languages, The Secret to Love That Lasts, the newest edition from Dr. Gary Chapman. Gary, thank you.
Thank you.
For Oasis Audio, I'm Wayne Shepherd.
Chapter 1. What happens to love after the wedding? At 30,000 feet, somewhere between Buffalo and Dallas, he put his magazine in his seat pocket, turned in my direction, and asked, "What kind of work do you do?" "I do marriage counseling and lead marriage enrichment seminars," I said, matter-of-factly. "I've been wanting to ask someone this for a long time," he said. "What happens to the love after you get married?" Relinquishing my hopes of getting a nap, I ask, "What do you mean?" "Well," he said, "I've been married 3 times, and each time it was wonderful before we got married. But somehow, after the wedding, it all fell apart. All the love that I thought I had for her and the love she seemed to have for me evaporated. I'm a fairly intelligent person. I operate a successful business, but I don't understand it." "How long were you married?" I asked. "The first one lasted about 10 years. The second time, we were married 3 years, and the last one, almost 6 years. Did your love evaporate immediately after the wedding, or was it a gradual loss?" I inquired. "Well, the second one went wrong from the very beginning. I don't know what happened. I really thought we loved each other, but the honeymoon was a disaster, and we never recovered. We only dated 6 months. It was a whirlwind romance. It was really exciting, but after the marriage, it was a battle from the beginning. In my first marriage, we had 3 or 4 good years before the baby came. After the baby was born, I felt like she gave her attention to the baby, and I no longer mattered. It was as if her one goal in life was to have a baby, and after the baby, she no longer needed me." "Did you tell her that?" I asked. "Yes, I told her. She said I was crazy. She said I did not understand the stress of being a 24-hour nurse. She said I should be more understanding and help her more. I really tried, but it didn't seem to make any difference. After that, we just grew further apart. After a while, there was no love left, just deadness. Both of us agreed that the marriage was over. My last marriage, I really thought that one would be different. I had been divorced for 3 years. We dated each other for 2 years. I really thought we knew what we were doing, and I thought that perhaps for the first time, I really knew what it meant to love someone. I genuinely felt that she loved me. After the wedding, I don't think I changed. I continued to express love to her as I had before the marriage. I told her how beautiful she was. I told her how much I loved her. I told her how proud I was to be her husband. But a few months after marriage, she started complaining about petty things at first, like my not taking the garbage out or not hanging up my clothes. Later, she went to attacking my character, telling me she didn't feel she could trust me, accusing me of not being faithful to her. She became a totally negative person. Before marriage, she was never negative. She was one of the most positive people I've ever met. That's one of the things that attracted me to her. She never complained about anything. Everything I did was wonderful. But once we were married, it seemed I could do nothing right. I honestly don't know what happened. Eventually, I lost my love for her and began to resent her. She obviously had no love for me. We agreed that there was no benefit to our living together any longer, so we split. That was a year ago. So my question is, what happens to love after the wedding? Is my experience common? Is that why we have so many divorces in our country? I can't believe that it happened to me 3 times. And those who don't divorce, do they learn to live with the emptiness? Or does the love really stay alive in some marriages? If so, how? The questions my friend seated in 5A was asking are the questions that thousands of married and divorced persons are asking today. Some are asking friends, some are asking counselors and clergy, and some are asking themselves. Sometimes the answers are couched in psychological research jargon that is almost incomprehensible. Sometimes they are couched in humor and folklore. Most of the jokes and pithy sayings contain some truth, but they are like offering an aspirin to a person with cancer. The desire for romantic love in marriage is deeply rooted in our psychological makeup. Books abound on the subject. Television and radio talk shows deal with it. The internet is full of advice. So are our parents and friends. Keeping love alive in our marriages is serious business. With all the help available from media experts, why is it that so few couples seem to have found the secret to keeping love alive after the wedding? Why is it that a couple can attend a communication workshop, hear wonderful ideas on how to enhance communication, return home, and find themselves totally unable to implement the communication patterns demonstrated? How is it that we see an expert on Oprah share tips on 101 ways to express love to your spouse? We select 2 or 3 ways that seem to be especially good to us, try them, and our spouse doesn't even acknowledge our effort. We give up on the other 98 ways and go back to life as usual. The truth we're missing. The answer to those questions is the purpose of this book. It is not that the books and articles already published are not helpful. The problem is that we have overlooked one fundamental truth. People speak different love languages. My academic training is in the area of anthropology. Therefore, I've studied in the area of linguistics, which identifies a number of major language groups: Japanese, Chinese, Spanish, English, Portuguese, Greek, German, French, and so on. Most of us grow up learning the language of our parents and siblings, which becomes our primary or native tongue. Later, we may learn additional languages, but usually with much more effort. These become our secondary languages. We speak and understand best our native language. We feel most comfortable speaking that language. The more we use a secondary language, the more comfortable we become conversing in it. If we speak only our primary language and encounter someone else who speaks only his or her primary language, which is different from ours, our communication will be limited. We must rely on pointing, grunting, drawing pictures, or acting out our ideas. We can communicate, but it is awkward. Language differences are part and parcel of human culture. If we are to communicate effectively across cultural lines, we must learn the language of those with whom we wish to communicate. In the area of love, it is similar. Your emotional love language and the language of your spouse may be as different as Chinese from English. No matter how hard you try to express love in English, if your spouse understands only Chinese, you will never understand how to love each other. My friend on the plane was speaking the language of affirming words to his third wife when he said, "I told her how beautiful she was. I told her I loved her. I told her how proud I was to be her husband." He was speaking love, and he was sincere, but she did not understand his language. Perhaps she was looking for love in his behavior and didn't see it. Being sincere is not enough. We must be willing to learn our spouse's primary love language if we are to be effective communicators of love. My conclusion, after 30 years of marriage counseling, is that there are 5 emotional love languages, 5 ways that people speak and understand emotional love. In the field of linguistics, a language may have numerous dialects or variations. Similarly, within the 5 basic emotional love languages, there are many dialects. That accounts for the magazine articles entitled, 10 Ways to Let Your Spouse Know You Love Her, 20 Ways to Keep Your Man at Home, or 365 Expressions of Marital Love. There are not 10, 20, or 365 basic love languages. In my opinion, there are only 5. However, there may be numerous dialects. The number of ways to express love within a love language is limited only by one's imagination. The important thing is to speak the love language of your spouse. Seldom do a husband and wife have the same primary emotional love language. We tend to speak our primary love language, and we become confused when our spouse does not understand what we are communicating. We are expressing our love, but the message does not come through because we're speaking what to them is a foreign language. Therein lies the fundamental problem, and it is the purpose of this book to offer a solution. That is why I dare to write another book on love. Once we discover the 5 basic love languages and understand our own primary love language as well as the primary love language of our spouse, we will then have the needed information to apply the ideas in the books and articles. Once you identify and learn to speak your spouse's primary love language, I believe that you will have discovered the key to a long-lasting, loving marriage. Love need not evaporate after the wedding, but in order to keep it alive, most of us will have to put forth the effort to learn a secondary love language. We cannot rely on our native tongue if our spouse does not understand it. If we want them to feel the love we're trying to communicate, we must express it in his or her primary love language. Your turn. Complete the following sentence. There would be fewer divorces if only people would... Chapter 2. Keeping the Love Tank Full. Love is the most important word in the English language, and the most confusing. Both secular and religious thinkers agree that love plays a central role in life. Thousands of books, songs, magazines, and movies are peppered with the word. numerous philosophical and theological systems have made a prominent place for love. Psychologists have concluded that the need to feel loved is a primary human emotional need. For love, we will climb mountains, cross seas, traverse desert sands, and endure untold hardships. Without love, mountains become unclimbable, seas uncrossable, deserts unbearable, and hardships our lot in life. If we can agree that the word love permeates human society, both historically and in the present, we must also agree that it is a most confusing word. We use it in a thousand ways. We say, I love hot dogs, and in the next breath, I love my mother. We speak of loving activities, swimming, skiing, hunting. We love objects, food, cars, houses. We love animals, dogs, cats, even pet snails. We love nature, trees, grass, flowers, and weather. We love people, mother, father, son, daughter, wives, husbands, friends. We even fall in love with love. If all of that is not confusing enough, we also use the word love to explain behavior. I did it because I love her. That explanation is given for all kinds of actions. A politician is involved in an adulterous relationship, and he calls it love. The preacher, on the other hand, calls it sin. The wife of an alcoholic picks up the pieces after her husband's latest episode. She calls it love, but the psychologist calls it codependency. The parent indulges all the child's wishes, calling it love. The family therapist would call it irresponsible parenting. What is loving behavior? The purpose of this book is not to eliminate all confusion surrounding the word love, but to focus on that kind of love that is essential to our emotional health. Child psychologists affirm that every child has certain basic emotional needs that must be met if he is to be emotionally stable. Among those emotional needs, none is more basic than the need for love and affection. The need to sense that he or she belongs and is wanted. With an adequate supply of affection, the child will likely develop into a responsible adult. Without that love, he or she will be emotionally and socially challenged. I liked the metaphor the first time I heard it. Inside every child is an emotional tank waiting to be filled with love. When a child really feels loved, he will develop normally. But when the love tank is empty, the child will misbehave. Much of the misbehavior of children is motivated by the cravings of an empty love tank. I was listening to Dr. Ross Campbell, a psychiatrist who specializes in the treatment of children and adolescents. As I listened, I thought of the hundreds of parents who had paraded the misdeeds of their children through my office. I had never visualized an empty love tank inside those children. But I had certainly seen the results of it. Their misbehavior was a misguided search for the love they did not feel. They were seeking love in all the wrong places and in all the wrong ways. I remember Ashley, who at 13 years of age was being treated for a sexually transmitted disease. Her parents were crushed. They were angry with Ashley. They were upset with the school, which they blamed for teaching her about sex. Why would she do this? They ask. In my conversation with Ashley, she told me of her parents' divorce when she was 6 years old. I thought my father left because he didn't love me, she said. When my mother remarried when I was 10, I felt she now had someone to love her, but I still had no one to love me. I wanted so much to be loved. I met this boy at school. He was older than me, but he liked me. I couldn't believe it. He was kind to me, and in a while, I really felt he loved me. I didn't want to have sex, but I wanted to be loved. Ashley's love tank had been empty for many years. Her mother and stepfather had provided for her physical needs, but had not realized the deep emotional struggle raging inside her. They certainly loved Ashley, and they thought that she felt their love. Not until it was almost too late did they discover that they were not speaking Ashley's primary love language. The emotional need for love, however, is not simply a childhood phenomena. That need follows us into adulthood and into marriage. The in-love experience temporarily meets that need, but it is inevitably a quick fix, and as we shall learn later, has a limited and predictable lifespan. After we come down from the high of the in-love obsession, the emotional need for love resurfaces because it is fundamental to our nature. It is at the center of our emotional desires. We needed love before we fell in love, and we will need it as long as we live. The need to feel loved by one's spouse is at the heart of marital desires. A man said to me recently, "What good is the house, the cars, the place at the beach, or any of the rest of it if your wife doesn't love you?" Do you understand what he was really saying? More than anything, I want to be loved by my wife. Material things are no replacement for human emotional love. A wife says, "He ignores me all day long and then wants to jump in bed with me. I hate it." She is not a wife who hates sex. She is a wife desperately pleading for emotional love. Our cry for love. Something in our nature cries out to be loved by another. Isolation is devastating to the human psyche. That is why solitary confinement is considered the cruelest of punishments. At the heart of humankind's existence is the desire to be intimate and to be loved by another. Marriage is designed to meet that need for intimacy and love. That is why the ancient biblical writings spoke of the husband and wife becoming one flesh. That did not mean that individuals would lose their identity. It meant that they would enter into each other's lives in a deep and intimate way. But if love is important, it is also elusive. I have listened to many married couples share their secret pain. Some came to me because the inner ache had become unbearable. Others came because they realized that their behavior patterns or the misbehavior of their spouse was destroying the marriage. Some came simply to inform me that they no longer wanted to be married. Their dreams of living happily ever after had been dashed against the hard walls of reality. Again and again, I have heard the words, "Our love is gone. Our relationship is dead. We used to feel close, but not now. We no longer enjoy being with each other. We don't meet each other's needs." Their stories bear testimony that adults, as well as children, have love tanks. Could it be that deep inside hurting couples exists an invisible emotional love tank with its gauge on empty? Could the misbehavior, withdrawal, harsh words, and critical spirit occur because of that empty tank? If we could find a way to fill it, could the marriage be reborn? With a full love tank, would couples be able to create an emotional climate where it is possible to discuss differences and resolve conflicts? Could that tank be the key that makes marriage work? Those questions sent me on a long journey. Along the way, I discovered the simple yet powerful insights contained in this book. The journey has taken me not only through 30 years of marriage counseling, but into the hearts and minds of hundreds of couples throughout America. From Seattle to Miami, couples have invited me into the inner chamber of their marriages, and we have talked openly. The illustrations included in this book are cut from the fabric of real life. Only names and places have been changed to protect the privacy of the individuals who have spoken so freely. I am convinced that keeping the emotional love tank full is as important to a marriage as maintaining the proper oil level is in an automobile. Running your marriage on an empty love tank may cost you even more than trying to drive your car without oil. What you're about to hear has the potential of saving thousands of marriages and can even enhance the emotional climate of a good marriage. Whatever the quality of your marriage now, it can always be better. Warning. Understanding the five love languages and learning to speak the primary love language of your spouse may radically affect his or her behavior. People behave differently when their emotional love tanks are full. Before we examine the five love languages, however, we must address one other important but confusing phenomenon, the euphoric experience of falling in love. Your turn. Has there ever been a time when you did something because you meant well, that is, out of loving motives? How did it turn out? Chapter 3, Falling in Love. She showed up at my office without an appointment and asked my secretary if she could see me for 5 minutes. I had known Janice for 18 years. She was 36 and had never married. From time to time, she had made appointments with me to discuss a particular difficulty in one of her dating relationships. She was, by nature, a conscientious, caring person, so it was completely out of character for her to show up at my office unannounced. I thought there must be some terrible crisis for Janice to come without an appointment. I told my assistant to show her in, and I fully expected to see her burst into tears and tell me some tragic story as soon as the door was closed. Instead, she practically skipped into my office, beaming with excitement. "How are you today, Janice?" I asked. "Great," she said. "I've never been better in my life. I'm getting married." "You are?" I said. "To whom?" "To David Gillespie," she explained, "in September." "That's exciting. How long have you been dating?" "3 weeks." "I know it's crazy, Dr. Chapman, after all the people I've dated and the number of times I've come so close to getting married. I can't believe it myself, but I know David is the one for me. From the first date, we both knew it. Of course, we didn't talk about it on the first night, but 1 week later, he asked me to marry him, and I knew he was going to ask me, and I knew I was going to say yes. I have never felt this way before. You know about the relationship that I've had through the years and the struggles I've had. In every relationship, something was not right. I never felt at peace about marrying any of them, but I know that David is the right one." By this time, Janice was rocking back and forth in her chair, giggling and saying, "I know it's crazy, but I'm so happy. I've never been this happy in my life." What has happened to Janice? She has fallen in love. In her mind, David is the most wonderful man she has ever met. He is perfect in every way. He will make the ideal husband. She thinks about him night and day. The fact that David has been married twice before, has 3 children, and has had 3 jobs in the past year are trivial to Janice. She's happy, and she's convinced that she is going to be happy forever with David. She is in love. Most of us enter marriage by way of the in-love experience. We meet someone whose physical characteristics and personality traits create enough electrical shock to trigger our love alert system. The bells go off, and we set in motion the process of getting to know the person. The first step may be sharing a hamburger or steak, depending on our budget. But our real interest is not in the food. We are on a quest to discover love. Could this warm, tingly feeling I have inside be the real thing? Sometimes we lose the tingles on the first date. We find out that he spends time on crackpot websites, or she attended 6 colleges, and the tingles run right out of our toes. We want no more hamburgers with them. Other times, however, the tingles are stronger after the hamburger than before. We arrange for a few more together experiences, and before long, the level of intensity has increased to the point where we find ourselves saying, "I think I'm falling in love." Eventually, we are convinced that it is the real thing, and we tell the other person, hoping the feeling is reciprocal. If it isn't, things cool off a bit, or we redouble our efforts to impress and eventually win the love of our beloved. When it is reciprocal, we start talking about marriage because everyone agrees that being in love is the necessary foundation for a good marriage. The anteroom of heaven. At its peak, the in-love experience is euphoric. We are emotionally obsessed with each other. We go to sleep thinking about one another. When we rise, that person's the first thought on our minds. We long to be together. Spending time together is like playing in the anteroom of heaven. When we hold hands, it seems as if our blood flows together. We could kiss forever if we didn't have to go to school or work. Embracing sparks dreams of marriage and ecstasy. The person who is in love, we'll call her Jen, has the illusion that her beloved is perfect. Her best friend can see the flaws. It bothers her how he talks to Jen sometimes, but Jen won't listen. Her mother, noting the young man seems unable to hold a steady job, keeps her concerns to herself, but asks polite questions about Ryan's plans. Our dreams before marriage are of marital bliss. We're going to make each other supremely happy. Other couples may argue and fight, but not us. We love each other. Of course, we are totally naive. We know intellectually that we will eventually have differences, but we are certain that we will discuss those differences openly. One of us will always be willing to make concessions, and we will reach agreement. It's hard to believe anything else when you're in love. We have been led to believe that if we are really in love, it will last forever. We will always have the wonderful feelings that we have at this moment. Nothing could ever come between us. Nothing will ever overcome our love for each other. We are caught up in the beauty and charm of the other's personality. Our love is the most wonderful thing we have ever experienced. We observe that some married couples seem to have lost that feeling, but it will never happen to us. Maybe they didn't have the real thing, we reason. Unfortunately, the eternality of the in-love experience is fiction, not fact. The late psychologist, Dr. Dorothy Teneff, conducted long-range studies on the in-love phenomenon. After studying scores of couples, she concluded that the average lifespan of a romantic obsession is 2 years. If it is a secretive love affair, it may last a little longer. Eventually, however, we all descend from the clouds and plant our feet on earth again. Our eyes are opened, and we see the warts of the other person. Her quirks are now merely annoying. He shows a capacity for hurt and anger, perhaps even harsh words and critical judgments. Those little traits that we overlooked when we were in love now become huge mountains. Reality intrudes. Welcome to the real world of marriage, where hairs are always on the sink and little white spots cover the mirror, where arguments center on which way the toilet paper comes off and whether the lid should be up or down. It is a world where shoes do not walk to the closet and drawers do not close themselves, where coats do not like hangers and socks go AWOL during laundry. In this world, a look can hurt and a word can crush. Intimate lovers can become enemies, and marriage a battlefield. What happened to the in-love experience? Alas, it was but an illusion by which we were tricked into signing our names on the dotted line for better or for worse. No wonder so many have come to curse marriage and the partner whom they once loved. After all, if we were deceived, we have a right to be angry. Did we really have the real thing? I think so. The problem was faulty information. The bad information was the idea that the in-love obsession would last forever. We should have known better. A casual observation should have taught us that if people remained obsessed, we would all be in serious trouble. The shockwaves would rumble through business, industry, church, education, and the rest of society. Why? Because people who are in love lose interest in other pursuits. That is why we call it obsession. The college student who falls head over heels in love sees his grades tumbling. It is difficult to study when you are in love. Tomorrow you have a test on the War of 1812. But who cares about the War of 1812? When you're in love, everything else seems irrelevant. A man said to me, "Dr. Chapman, my job is disintegrating." "What do you mean?" I asked. "I met this girl, fell in love. I can't get a thing done. I can't keep my mind on my job. I spend my day dreaming about her." The euphoria of the in-love state gives us the illusion that we have an intimate relationship. We feel that we belong to each other. We believe we can conquer all problems. We feel altruistic toward each other. As one young man said about his fiancée, "I can't conceive of doing anything to hurt her. My only desire is to make her happy. I would do anything to make her happy." Such obsession gives us the false sense that our egocentric attitudes have been eradicated and we have become a sort of Mother Teresa, willing to give anything for the benefit of our lover. The reason we can do that so freely is that we sincerely believe our lover feels the same way towards us. We believe that she is committed to meeting our needs, that he loves us as much as we love him, and would never do anything to hurt us. That thinking is always fanciful. Not that we are insincere in what we think and feel, but we are unrealistic. We fail to reckon with the reality of human nature. By nature, we are egocentric. Our world revolves around us. None of us is totally altruistic. The euphoria of the in-love experience only gives us that illusion. Once the experience of falling in love has run its natural course, remember, the average in-love experience lasts 2 years, we will return to the world of reality and begin to assert ourselves. He will express his desires. but his desires will be different from hers. He wants sex, but she is too tired. He dreams of buying a new car, but she flatly says, "We can't afford it." She would like to visit her parents, but he says, "I don't like spending so much time with your family." Little by little, the illusion of intimacy evaporates, and the individual desires, emotions, thoughts, and behavior patterns assert themselves. They are two individuals. Their minds have not melded together, and their emotions mingled only briefly in the ocean of love. Now, the waves of reality begin to separate them. They fall out of love, and at that point, either they withdraw, separate, divorce, and set off in search of a new in-love experience, or they begin the hard work of learning to love each other without the euphoria of the in-love obsession. Some couples believe that the end of the in-love experience means that they have only two options: resign themselves to a life of misery with their spouse, or jump ship and try again. Our generation has opted for the latter, whereas an earlier generation often chose the former. Before we automatically conclude that we have made the better choice, perhaps we should examine the data. According to a substantial body of research, the divorce rate for second marriages is at least 60% and rises when children are involved. Research seems to indicate that there is a third and better alternative. We can recognize the in-love experience for what it is, a temporary emotional high, and now pursue real love with our spouse. That kind of love is emotional in nature, but not obsessional. It is a love that unites reason and emotion. It involves an act of the will and requires discipline, and it recognizes the need for personal growth. Our most basic emotional need is not to fall in love, but to be genuinely loved by another, to know a love that grows out of reason and choice, not instinct. I need to be loved by someone who chooses to love me, who sees in me something worth loving. That kind of love requires effort and discipline. It is the choice to expend energy in an effort to benefit the other person, knowing that if his or her life is enriched by your effort, you too will find a sense of satisfaction, the satisfaction of having genuinely loved another. It does not require the euphoria of the in-love experience. In fact, true love cannot begin until the in-love experience has run its course. We cannot take credit for the kind of generous things we do while under the influence of the obsession. We are pushed and carried along by an instinctual force that goes beyond our normal behavior patterns. But if, once we return to the real world of human choice, we choose to be kind and generous, that is real love. The emotional need for love must be met if we are to have emotional health. Married adults long to feel affection and love from their spouses. We feel secure when we are assured that our spouse accepts us, wants us, and is committed to our well-being. During the in-love stage, we felt all of those emotions. It was heavenly while it lasted. Our mistake was in thinking it would last forever. But that obsession was not meant to last forever. In the textbook of marriage, it is but the introduction. The heart of the book is rational, volitional love. That is, the kind of love to which the sages have always called us. It is intentional. That is good news to the married couple who have lost all of their in-love feelings. If love is a choice, then we have the capacity to love after the in-love obsession has died and they have returned to the real world. That kind of love begins with an attitude, a way of thinking. Love is the attitude which says, "I am married to you, and I choose to look out for your interest." Then, the one who chooses to love will find appropriate ways to express that decision. But it seems so sterile, some may contend. Love is an attitude with appropriate behavior? Where are the shooting stars, the balloons, the deep emotions? What about the spirit of anticipation, the twinkle of the eye, the electricity of a kiss, the excitement of sex? What about the emotional security of knowing that I am number one in his or her mind? That is what this book is all about. How do we meet each other's deep emotional need to feel loved? If we can learn that and choose to do it, then the love we share will be exciting beyond anything we ever felt when we were infatuated. For many years now, I have discussed the five emotional love languages in my marriage seminars and in private counseling sessions. Thousands of couples will attest to the validity of what you are about to hear. My files are filled with letters from people whom I have never met saying, "A friend loaned me one of your lectures on love languages, and it has revolutionized our marriage. We had struggled for years trying to love each other, but our efforts had missed each other emotionally. Now that we're speaking the appropriate love languages, the emotional climate of our marriage has radically improved." When your spouse's emotional love tank is full and he feels secure in your love, the whole world looks bright and your spouse will move out to reach his highest potential in life. But when the love tank is empty and he feels used but not loved, the whole world looks dark and he will likely never reach his potential for good in the world. In the next five chapters, I will explain the five emotional love languages, and then in chapter 9, illustrate how discovering your spouse's primary love language can make your efforts at love most productive. Your turn. Look back on that point in your marriage when reality set in and the initial romantic feelings faded. How did this affect your relationship, for better or for worse? Chapter 4. Love language number 1, words of affirmation. Mark Twain once said, "I can live for 2 months on a good compliment." If we take Twain literally, 6 compliments a year would keep his emotional love tank at the operational level. Your spouse will probably need more. One way to express love emotionally is to use words that build up. Solomon, the author of the ancient Hebrew wisdom literature, wrote, "The tongue has the power of life and death." Many couples have never learned the tremendous power of verbally affirming each other. Solomon further noted, "An anxious heart weighs a man down, but a kind word cheers him up." Verbal compliments, or words of appreciation, are powerful communicators of love. They are best expressed in simple, straightforward statements of affirmation, such as, "You look sharp in that suit." "Do you ever look hot in that dress? Wow! I really like how you're always on time to pick me up at work. Thanks for getting the babysitter lined up tonight. I want you to know I don't take that for granted. I love how you are so responsible. I feel like I can count on you." What would happen to the emotional climate of a marriage if the husband and wife heard such words of affirmation regularly? Several years ago, I was sitting in my office with my door open. A lady walking down the hall said, "Have you got a minute?" "Sure, come in." She sat down and said, "Dr. Chapman, I've got a problem. I can't get my husband to paint our bedroom. I have been after him for 9 months. I've tried everything I know. I can't get him to paint the bedroom." My first thought was, "Lady, you are at the wrong place. I am not a paint contractor." But I said, "Tell me about it." She said, "Well, last Saturday was a good example. You remember how pretty it was? Do you know what my husband did all day long? He worked on updating his computer." "So what did you do?" "I went in there and said, 'Dan, I don't understand you. Today would have been a perfect day to paint the bedroom, and here you are working on your computer.'" "So, did he paint the bedroom?" I inquired. "No, it's still not painted. I don't know what to do." "Let me ask you a question," I said. "Are you opposed to computers?" "No, but I want the bedroom painted." "Are you certain that your husband knows that you want the bedroom painted?" "I know he does," she said. "I've been after him for 9 months." "Let me ask you one more question. Does your husband ever do anything good?" "Like what?" "Oh, like taking the garbage out, or getting bugs off the windshield of the car you drive, or putting gas in the car, or paying the electric bill, or hanging up his coat?" "Yes," she said, "he does some of those things." "Then I have 2 suggestions. One, don't ever mention painting the bedroom again." I repeated, "Don't ever mention it again." "I don't see how that's going to help," she said. "Look, you just told me that he knows that you want the bedroom painted. You don't have to tell him anymore. He already knows. The second suggestion I have is that the next time your husband does anything good, give him a verbal compliment. If he takes the garbage out, say, 'Dan, I want you to know that I really appreciate your taking the garbage out.' Don't say, 'About time you took the garbage out. The flies were going to carry it out for you.' If you see him paying the electric bill, put your hand on his shoulder and say, "Dan, I really appreciate your paying the electric bill. I hear there are husbands who don't do that, and I want you to know how much I appreciate it." Or, "I really appreciated you taking the kids off my hands when I had to finish that project." Every time he does something good, give him a verbal compliment. I don't see how that's going to get the bedroom painted. "You asked for my advice," I said. "You have it. It's free." She wasn't very happy with me when she left. 3 weeks later, however, she came back to my office and said, "It worked." She had learned that verbal compliments are far greater motivators than nagging words. I'm not suggesting verbal flattery.